Hi, guys. First of all, congratulations to all of you for being here on the very last night of the two-year Discovering Buddhism cycle. It's wonderful to have you here. And in honor of our coming to the end of this two-year cycle, we're going to have a celebration next week. So if you have come to any class at all, you don't have to have come to all of them, please do come next week, same time, same place. Gesa will be here for a little while at the beginning, and then we'll party hardy when he while he's here, not when the cat's away. And even though Discovering Buddhism is ending, never fear, there are other options. I would really encourage you, if you are not coming on Wednesday nights, to come. That's when Geshe Gelug teaches on the Lam Rim. And I think it's a really good next step for you to take, especially because it's with Geshe Gelug. So that's on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock. And he's teaching out of the Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand. So I don't remember where we are exactly, but he is teaching from that book right now. So please come. Also in November and the first part of December, just so you all don't get too lonely for your Discovering Buddhism crowd, we're going to be having discussion, just Dharma discussion groups. I think it's a really wonderful idea. It's going to be open-ended. You can ask the questions that you never get a chance to ask in DB, or you get a chance to ask and there isn't time to really go into it in the depth you want to go into it. Erin is going to be our fabulous facilitator. Yay, Erin. Thank you, Erin, for 2 years of your service to this class. Thank you, Chris and Brian. Chris is standing in for Brian, but thank you both for all you've done. And I have another thank you to make, and this is in line with at Kadampa Center. We want to, you know, we try to live what we teach, and part of what we teach is the law of causation, that anything that we want to experience in our lives, we need to create the causes for them. And we're all here because we want to experience the teachings. And so out of our gratitude for Dom, we have a little offering for him. Thank you.
All right, and as we usually do, I have a card for us to sign for the teacher, but it'll kind of circulate if it's appropriate timing, sign it. If not, you can stick around afterwards and sign it. An announcement that we should make quite often, or something that we should be thinking about quite often, is, as Don alluded to, the causes and conditions that enable us to be here. So we create these causes and conditions in our life, and due to the actions of others, we are able to come here to this center and be able to practice. It's an amazing thing. It's very rare. It's more rare than we can even think about. And so we just need to take a moment and think about, if this is of benefit to us, how we want to create, to make it something that other people can benefit from as well. And for something, a tradition that has been at the Kadampa Center since it was founded, is it 25 or 20? 25. It was 25 last year. Don should know because he was there at the beginning helping this all get started. So is that every teaching that we have is just offered freely and relies on your donations to make this continuing to happen. So if you've benefited from this at all, or if you want this to be in existence for others to benefit from in the future, then that relies on you making donations to keep the center going. I think we just kicked off our annual campaign. So one way to get really organized is between now and the end of the year, getting set up as a sustainer, yes, absolutely. That's a really organized way to do it. But I think also anytime anything moves your heart, you know, you have a few extra dollars, just that any time that you give, just like based on a pure generosity, just based on the feeling of it, I think that that's a wonderful thing to do and kind of creates the habit to give more. So giving any tiny little bit helps you create that habit to give more. And I think as important as becoming a sustainer is just those little moments and those little ways that you practice. And I'll say this too, because one person who's taking over for me in January is Linda. And so some of you are going to be doing this course again, because you can just keep getting more and more out of it. We used to work together a lot in the children's program, and I remember every time I called Linda, if I needed help, she would say, like, her immediate reaction was like, oh, can I, if I can, I want to, I really want to. Like, that is really the feeling that I got every time that I called Linda. So I would say that just that, it's just been so inspirational for me to be around people who have that kind of spontaneous generosity, that spontaneous, like, desire to give in any way that they can, whether it's their time, whether that it's money, you know. So that's one reason that I really appreciate being here, is because I have so many good examples around me. So that's my rambling speech about that. If you need practical information about giving to the Kanamba Center, the intro sheet that the sheet that we give out on the first day has a bunch of information on the back.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So this is so nice to relax, isn't it? Get away from Home Depot. By the way, I'm bringing back my, that's another story. So let's start out with a couple of minutes of meditation and settle the mind, and then I'll do a little bodhicitta motivation, which I think is, you know, Lama Yeshe, who's my, you know, he was the person, he's kind of my guru, but Lama Zopa's, they were good cop, bad cop. Lama Yeshe was always joking around. He was very charismatic. Lama Zopa seemed to be more austere, but I needed them both. And, but anyway. So, we're going to start out. Lama Yeshe always said the motivation is like, if you meditated for an hour and you spent 59 minutes setting the motivation, that 1 minute of meditation, I'm exaggerating a little bit, this is about what he said, then that 1 minute of meditation will be valuable. But if your motivation is screwy or not clear or all about is self-centered, benefit not too much. Benefits. So we need to spend, you know, tonight, we're getting ready to do a little marathon, 2 hours. We'll stretch our legs from time to time, but we need to set the motivation. So start out by just doing mindfulness of the breath, and you want to sit up straight and bring your attention to your body and scan from head to toe. And if you find that you're holding on to any tension, just take a few cleansing breaths and relax. And bring your attention then back to just simply watching the in-breath and the out-breath, whether it be, you know, just the experience of it, or it could be the sensation of the nose, the rising and falling of the chest, rising and falling of the abdomen, or just even just following the breath as it comes in and then following the breath as it goes out. But do not lose your awareness of the breath for even a millisecond. You want to be completely focused on the experience. And then when you lose it, you come back 1,000 times if you need to. So the rarity of Tantra is this particular esoteric teaching of the Buddha. We haven't really talked about it, but it's extremely rare and a precious opportunity for people who are qualified. And maybe we're not qualified now, but we need, if we feel like a certain attraction to this path, this is something that suits our temperament, our karma, then we need to get ourselves qualified. It's said that in this great eon, long time, right? An eon. In this great eon, there'll be 1,000 teaching Buddhas. Alright? Shakyamuni Buddha is said to be the fourth teaching Buddha in this eon. And he's, of all the 1,000 Buddhas, he's the only one that is supposed to teach Tantra or the Vajrayana methods. So it's sort of amazingly rare opportunity that we have come into, just to hear the word. Amazing. I mean, just to have, you know, enough time in our life to come and hear about the teachings. Even, you know, amazing to have some karmic connection with these teachings, whether it just be to hear this information. Is very rare and precious opportunity. So the qualified student for Tantra is someone who has developed these things. We'll talk about this later on tonight, but it can't be emphasized enough. It's renunciation, which is a weird word, but translated into this determination to be free. And that, to be free from what? To be free from suffering. What? I'm not suffering. Well, then we don't, if we don't think we're suffering, we probably wouldn't be here. But if we look at our situation, we realize our mind is a mess, constantly going here and there, never a moment peace. What we want in a heart of heart is lasting joy and peace. We don't have that. So, you know, we want to be free of suffering so we can experience lasting joy and peace. But it also implies that we have the confidence that we can actually do that. You know, this renunciation implies that, you know, I want to be free of suffering. And it's possible. We have some confidence that it's possible not just others to be free of suffering, but for me to be free of suffering. So this is really all about having compassion for yourself. You know, this determination to be free of suffering is having compassion for yourself and believing that it's possible. And that's not something that you're going to believe in because you hear me or Geshe-la or the Dalai Lama, you know, say it or write it down. It's going to be something that we prove to ourselves. Little by little, we see our suffering diminish and our happiness increase. And we go, wow, there's something to this. This really works for me. Or maybe it doesn't. And then we move on. It's okay. So renunciation and then bodhicitta. That's like the most important part of, for me, I mean, it's the reason that I am so, I think Tibetan Vajrayana, Mahayana Buddhism is so wonderful because it really talks about, you know, getting your act together, not just for your own happiness, which happens as a byproduct of dedicating your life to others. You dedicate your spiritual awakening, eliminating your faults, cultivating your good qualities, you know, wisdom, compassion, kindness, power, skillful means, all the qualities that make up a Buddha. You set your sight at developing those qualities, not only for yourself, but really so you can help others. Ultimately, the goal is to enlighten all living beings. And again, the byproduct of this dedication to others is your happiness just comes along. It just happens as a byproduct without even trying. It's like you work so hard to find your own happiness. When we dedicate our lives to others, everything we want comes effortlessly. So this bodhicitta must become enlightened in order to liberate all sentient beings, all living beings, and it's based on genuine love and compassion, not some sentimental stuff. But, you know, it's the words, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness, that's the definition of love. But that's not love. You think of somebody that you really, in your heart of hearts, love. Think about them right now. And notice the feeling that goes with that. If that feeling could speak, it would say, may you be happy and have the causes of happiness. And then, again, if you see this person that you love is suffering, you think, just bring to mind something that is causing them to suffer. and think, may you be free of suffering and its causes. That's the definition of compassion, but that's not compassion, is it? You think about their suffering and wish them to be free from it. Notice the feeling in your heart. That's compassion. That's the feeling. That's compassion, not these words. So based on genuine love and compassion for universal living beings, not just my friends, but for strangers and the people that we feel aversion toward, cannot exclude anybody. We dedicate ourselves to this amazing state where we develop all of our qualities and eliminate our faults. Slowly, slowly we can do that. So that's bodhicitta. And then emptiness is just seeing things as they are. Lama Yeshe used to try to simplify it. He said it's sort of like we do this glorified paint job. You know, it's like we spray paint reality. You know, we create this, we got this canvas and we just spray paint it and put paint all over it. And we lose track of the canvas and then we believe in the images that we create. And we live our lives in reaction to these images. We need to scrape away the paint and see what's really there. The paint's part of it, but that's not the only thing that's there. We believe in the paint, but what's true is that our vision of ourselves in reality is empty of that truly existent, seemingly inner and independently existent self and other. We project a false reality and believe it. And what we're empty of, and what reality is empty of, is that false reality, that fantasized reality. We strip it away and see things as they are. And when we do that, we can access our full potential. Our potential, our Buddha nature is naturally compassionate, naturally loving, naturally wise and powerful and skillful. But it's so much gradue, so it's obscured by so many layers of confusion and novels that we've written about ourselves and others, and we have to strip that away. And that's the beauty of Tantra, because that's where this can be done, and done very quickly. And so the ideal student for Tantra is someone who has this impatient compassion, you might say. Just cannot bear the suffering of beings. Seeing how everyone believes in a fantasized false reality and gets drawn into all of these destructive states of mind, clinging attachment, aversion, hatred, fear, jealousy, pride, all of it's based on our false projection of reality. And we believe in our projection. And when we realize, when a Buddha or a Bodhisattva sees how we get sucked in to suffering based on our mistaken perceptions, compassion just naturally arises. Our basic nature is pure. And that's the starting point for Tantra, is to working with our Buddha nature, our pure, unobscured, empty nature of the mind. So, to practice Tantra, we need to have what we just talked about, at least an intellectual understanding of renunciation, compassion for yourself, bodhicitta, compassion for others, and this seeing reality as it is. We have a taste for that. We can a little bit of taste for that. And we have some respect and confidence that the tantric path, is a valid path and can deliver on what it says it promises. And then, thirdly, we meet the qualified teacher. We meet a qualified tantric master who's done these practices for Geshe Gelug. You know, his main practice is tantra. He'd never tell you that, but that's what he does. I mean, that's what all of these great teachers do, is their main practices are tantra, and tantra strengthens the understanding of the three principles of the path. They're not, you know, there's tantra over here, and there's the three principles and the sutra over there. It's not that way at all. So with this motivation of bodhicitta, for, you know, may we, you know, use this tonight and the rest of our lives to wake up from the sleep of ignorance and to achieve our full potential for the sake of others. You know, how wonderful, how great that would be to have that be the motivation. So unselfish, isn't it? There's not ego, not an inkling of ego in that motivation. None whatsoever. So with that motivation, everything we do becomes a cause of enlightenment and happiness for ourselves and others. If you get a feeling of what this bodhicitta is like, just allow that feeling to just focus on the feeling, the experience. Now relax your tension. Bring your awareness back to your feet and your body. Sorry. Just kidding. Well, we do, but we don't. I'm going to pass out there. I hope I have enough of these. I copied a bunch off the computer at home. I mean, at the office. Probably enough. Do you mind passing these around? You hold on to one, because this is the final exam for her. Yeah, this is your final exam, too. This is everybody's final exam. So, we're just going to whip through these pages pretty quickly here. This is the didactic part of it. Most of this is what you need, you know, if you were taking a quiz or something. These are the high points. I may expand on a little bit, but these are the high points. So we've already talked about the first one. Let me issue. Everybody got a copy? I've got some. If you need to make more copies, we can. Do you got enough? Okay. Okay. All right. I've got one just doesn't have, anyway. Okay. So, the first question, you know, Lama Yeshe gave the following, I think John Landau came up with this quiz here. Emerging, opening, and dissolving. Honestly, I don't find those terms that helpful, but, you know, I still like renunciation, bodhicitta, and nirvana. But that's what he's talking about. Renunciation, definite emergence. I mean, that sounds like Alex Berzin. I guess you'd call him a Buddhologist. Anyway, he lives in Berlin these days, but he's from New Jersey. And that's his translation of renunciation is definite emergence or determination to be free, things like that. It says, furthermore, in the practice of tantric meditation can lead to attainment of various extraordinary abilities or powers, as well as the experience of bliss. If we'd been smart, we would have advertised it this way. Wisdom, desire, and bliss would have had a lot more people here than the introduction to Tantra. If we have not developed renunciation, it's possible to become attached to these powers and blissful experiences, and such attachment would be a hindrance to our spiritual development. So, again, in Tantra, there's a real emphasis on cultivating this blissful awareness, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. Again, opening is generating bodhicitta. We just talked about that. Furthermore, with a strong bodhicitta motivation, we might practice. I'm sorry. Without a strong bodhicitta motivation, we might practice Tantra for selfish reasons instead of leading to Buddhahood. This would only increase one's self-grasping, ignorance, and self-cherishing. So again, that points out how important compassion is for, and like I said, this impatient compassion where you just cannot, you know, it's kind of watching your, by the way, I met a lady recently, she might be like 55, and a year ago, her son was killed in a car. Her only child was a boy. Her son was killed in a motor vehicle accident. He was riding with a girl who was drunk, and she crashed the car. She got out of, she was fine, unscathed, but he was killed. You know, just cannot imagine how, you know, terrible that must be, how much pain that must cause. You know, that suffering that she must be experiencing. And, you know, she cannot even, you know, she can't, you know, I talked to her, you know, she can't get her mind off of it, really, and you can imagine it would be so. But in a positive way, bodhicitta is the same way. It's like once we develop an understanding or a realization of bodhicitta, it's never off of our mind. Mind's always completely focused on bodhicitta. So, and without it, you know, we end up being Darth Vader instead of an enlightened being. And then dissolving. So, you know, emerging, renunciation, opening, bodhicitta, and dissolving, cultivating the wisdom of emptiness, the actual way that things exist. Alright, then, number two. The sutra is called the causal path to enlightenment. What is Tantra called? Why? Explain the difference between the two approaches. Alright, so here are the answers. Tantra is called the resultant path to enlightenment. Anyway, sutra practitioners concentrate on cultivating the various causes now that will lead to the attainment of enlightenment in the future. These causes are the practice of the six perfections. So these are the, you know, anybody, the bodhisattva path basically is the path of the practice of the six perfections. So what are these? They're generosity, and it's there are different kinds of generosity, not just material generosity, but even giving safety. And giving safety. I always think about that one. I think, God, to be the kind of person, what a generous thing to do, to be somebody who lives ethically, who's got a good heart, who like when other people around, they feel safe. Giving people safety, protection. Not just protecting people when they're being beat up, but that kind of generosity. And then the generosity of giving the Dharma. It's another form. Then ethical self-discipline. You know, it's like anybody who thinks that spiritual practice can take us anywhere without having a basis of ethics is completely deluded and has no awareness whatsoever. Because usually when our behavior has been pretty random, our meditations are all about what we've done in the past that has a lot of ouches. Oh, I did that. Ouch. Ooh. You know, it's a lot of regret. And so really have to be careful and not harm ourselves or others. So ethics is so important. Ethical self-discipline. And it's not morality. It's just non-harming. It just refers to non-harming. And so there's a lot of this, the 10 non-virtuous actions. So what are they? You know, there's the 3 of body and the 4 of speech and the 3 of mind. The heaviest ones are the physical non-virtuous actions. Killing. It's the worst non-virtuous action of all. Taking a life. Particularly a human life, because humans are closer to having the potential to be fully enlightened Buddhists. Taking a life, even rejoicing in somebody taking a life, creates the same karma as having taken a life. So we don't want to be that one, do we? So, got to be careful. You know, I remember when 9/11 hit, you know, and everybody was like, you know, hating the, kind of glad that the people that flew the planes into the building died too, you know. And, you know, but as a Buddhist, you feel bad, you try to cultivate compassion even for the perpetrator. You know, you try to cultivate compassion even for those bad guys. But anyway, so there's 3, so killing and stealing, which is taking not what's freely given, and adultery, which is, it's bigger than that. It's more like sexual behavior that harms others. You know, adultery is the one that stands out, but we can think of lots of other ways, manipulating people and so forth, and those ways that harmful sexual behavior. So those are 3 of the body, and the 4 of speech are lying. You know, we can deceive people by not saying things, can't we? Like, just, you know. So there's lots of ways to lie without speaking. But we really think of it as the verbal thing. But there's the nonverbal lying too. Lying, slander, which is bad-mouthing people. Lying, harsh speech, which is speech that disturbs others. And frivolous gossip, you know, and that encompasses so much, probably encompasses looking at your cell phone half the night, you know, trying to check on your Facebook page and all that kind of stuff. Idle gossip. Just think of the thousands of hours that people spend. Even now they can tell you how much time you spend on your cell phone a day. Ooh, watch out for that one. Yeah. So there's lying, slander, harsh, and frivolous speech. Okay, those are the ones, verbal ones, and then greed, which includes attachment, desire, clinging, and all of that. Hatred, which includes aversion. You know, but hatred actually, we project on somebody. Negative qualities are way beyond what that's there, and we actually want to harm them. That's what hatred is. There's nothing virtuous about hatred or anger because that's what comes out of hatred. I want to harm that person. That's never going to be a good thing. Well, that, you know, if it's motivated by anger and this kind of negative egocentric mind, and then ignorance, without going into too much detail, we've talked about that. So those are the three of a body, four speech, three of mind. So that's just basic ethics, no big deal. But by taking vows, or at least trying to live by these ten, avoiding these ten non-virtuous actions to the degree we can, but being mindful of these things. So right now, is anybody killing? I don't think anybody's killing anything right now. So actually, we're practicing non-killing. Congratulations, that's good. But if you take a vow to not kill, then every second that you're not killing, you're creating virtue. You're creating good karma. But really, this internal vow to not kill really comes, you know, it really becomes important when you're in a situation where you can take a life and you choose not to. And it could be a mosquito, you know, you go, without even thinking, but you go, oops, and you go, and flip it off. All right? Or, you know, So I'm not going into killing, but we all know what killing is. I mean, we can kill people, you know, we can kill animals, So that one's. Pardon?
The mosquito one.
Yeah, the mosquito one, but we got just we'll do the best we can. That's what we do. Off, by the way, is real good for that. So the ethical self-discipline, real important. Got to be aware. So we can avoid stealing. When we're walking by something that we really want and we don't steal it, that's when we're practicing avoiding stealing, right? Because right now nobody's stealing anything, right? But it's when we're confronted with a situation where we might take something that doesn't belong to us, you know, and we don't do it. That's when we're practicing avoiding stealing and adultery and lying and slander, all of those things. So we have to be mindful of these negative actions of body, speech, and mind. And then we're confronted with a situation where we might do these things. We don't do them. We restrain ourselves. So you notice that Buddhism notices, it doesn't say thou shalt not, does it? It doesn't say that. It says avoid. And there's a very good reason for that. The main reason is because a Buddha, an enlightened being, could potentially take a life of another living being and have it be motivated by pure compassion, no ego whatsoever, and have that actually be at least a mixed action, but not totally negative anyway. But for us, when we kill, it's always going to be primarily motivated by self-interest, by egocentric self-cherishing. When we steal, same thing. Adultery, same thing. All of these negative actions of body, speech, and mind, the common denominator is always self-cherishing selfishness. Okay? No doubt about that. And every time we act in that way, we're going to suffer. And we don't want to suffer. So, that's, you know, in a nutshell, ethical self-discipline. Patience. We'll come back to that because in a moment we're going to be doing a purification practice where we're going to be purifying the negative karmas of body, speech, and mind. Okay? And we've been killing and stealing and committing adultery for eons. If you didn't do it in this lifetime, you've done it in past lifetimes, countless times. This is how Buddhists think, because we don't think of it as just one lifetime. So we've done all this negative stuff. We're not so pure. Just because we didn't do this thing doesn't mean we haven't done it in the past. So we have negative karma of all of these things, of body, speech, and mind, that need to be purified. So we're going to do Vajrasattva next in a little bit, and we're going to purify whole bunches of negative karma, eons of it. All right. Then there's patience, which is avoiding anger, right? Avoiding being consumed by anger. Tolerance, being tolerant. So patience is pretty self-explanatory. But most people, honestly, it's very interesting. Most of us don't even think of anger. We think of anger as a protector. You know, as like, well, if there's social injustice, by golly, I need to get angry and make something and change something, right? Well, we can be incensed by social injustice. We can see the injustice of it without getting angry. And furthermore, anger paralyzes the most helpful parts of our mind, which are wisdom and compassion. Impossible for a mind which is consumed by anger to access wisdom and compassion. If we want to solve a problem, we need wisdom and compassion, not anger. So we see the reality of the injustice, and then motivated by wisdom and compassion, we try to fix it. We don't have to be incensed and outraged and lose make ourselves miserable and create enormous amount of negative karma and maybe even harm ourselves and get harmed or harm others. Don't have to do that. So patience really has to do with this, you know, not giving in to this impulse, which is so self-centered, of anger. Just because ego doesn't get what it wants. When desire is frustrated, wham, there's anger. I want this to happen, and it doesn't, anger. I want this to happen, or I want this in my life, and it's not there. Or I want it, and it leaves, anger. Okay? We don't need that. Anger is, you know, so patience is so important in the Bodhisattva path. Then effort, enthusiastic effort. Effort in the practice of virtue. So this is what Aaron was talking about earlier. It's like this joyful effort, enjoying practicing virtue, enjoying the practice of virtue. Yeah, so important. So important. And then concentration, you know. By the way, you can't do all of these. You can't have a meditation practice and really develop concentration without having the first four, can you? You gotta have the generosity and so forth. Helps create a lot of merit. Ethical self-discipline helps keep our mind clean and not full of regret and patience and so forth. And effort. And now we're ready to put the supreme effort and develop a mind that's like a laser concentration. So the Bodhisattva has to have a laser-like mind where they can take this really this really focused state of mind, focus it on any object and penetrate that object and understand it and actually gain a realization of it. So if it's bodhicitta, that is to see it. To see it clearly, to develop that experience of bodhicitta and the feeling of bodhicitta and hold on to it for 4 hours. Then you got it. You got concentration. If you can develop focus on anything without being disturbed for 4 hours, but it could take a lifetimes to get there, to get that 4 hours. Alright, so concentration is important, and then wisdom is what we keep talking about, the wisdom seeing reality as it is. So this is what the sutra practitioners, this is the foundation of Tantra, and without this, just, you know, don't even go there. Lama Yeshe used to say there were a lot of Western students who would go and read all these fancy tantric texts and think it was all about exotic ritualized sex and blah 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 blah, and they'd go off and practice it, and he'd say it was stupid because they had no foundation. They it's like building a house, you know, at low tide, you know, at the beach. forget it. It's going to get washed away. There's no foundation for the practice of Tantra without having this stuff in place. And then Tantric practitioner takes future result of one's practice, full enlightenment, and brings it into the present moment. So what does that mean? You know, again, this has to do with, we'll talk about it in a minute, but it has to do with emptiness yoga, where we meditate. We have to let go of our poor me, I am so limited, I can never get it, you know, I could never stop my own suffering. And furthermore, just to be happy would be good enough, but to actually be blissfully happy and become a Buddha, impossible. I could never do that. And yet, in Tantra, through using this emptiness yoga, this deity yoga practice, we dissolve our ordinary sense of self into the space of emptiness. And then we arise, we imagine ourselves, excuse me, as a Buddha now. We think, I am an enlightened being now. Now, it's not the ordinary sense of I, is it? If you think that you're a Buddha now, but in reality you think you're just this ordinary body and mind, polluted, limited and all that, and then you imagine yourself as a deity, it's like putting on a wetsuit. There's no reality. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is dissolving completely, letting go of every self-limiting view you've ever had of yourself, and even your vision of yourself disappears into the space of emptiness. And then from the space of emptiness, we imagine that we arise, say, as Tara, as this a green lady, 16-year-old, made of light, green in color, you know, like a hologram, not one atom of solidity. And she embodies all the compassionate action of the Buddhas. And you imagine, I am Tara now. And what you need to have, two things. You need to have a clear appearance of yourself as Tara, right? Clear appearance gets rid of our ordinary view of ourselves, which is very limiting. And then, you know, we see ourselves as a Buddha, as completely empty. Completely empty. We see ourselves as a Buddha now. So that gets rid of our ordinary conceptions. So clear appearance and having this correct view. So important in the practice of Tantra. So now we imagine, and we call it divine pride. You say, okay, I am, and not I, in my case, Don. We think, I, Tara, am a Buddha now. And you take pride in your Buddha nature, which is now erupted in a sense, or evolved into this perfect being. So our Buddha nature, which is our basic nature, we've tapped into that and allow it to manifest as, in this case, Green Tara. And we take pride in being a Buddha now with perfect compassion. You know, no flaws at all in our form. Form is that of a perfect, usually they say a 16-year-old female, but in a just perfect in every way. There's no flaws. The mind is completely empty. Every atom of Tara's being, which is, like I said, is totally non-solid, exists only to eliminate the suffering of others. You know, so Tara, you know, I am Tara, and my body and it's completely empty and only exists to eliminate the suffering of others. And I can take action to make that happen. And so you have this thing called divine pride. Divine pride in being the deity now. Okay? So that's what we call it, the resultant path, because we're taking our future result, which is we have Buddha nature, just needs to be cultivated, just needs to be cleaned up and cultivated. We take that Buddha nature, and because eventually we will be a Buddha, and we imagine that we're that now. We're taking the future result, our enlightenment, and we're imagining that we're that now, but not the ego-centric self that we know ourselves to be, but our Buddha nature self is a Buddha now. Okay? That's why it's so powerful. No limitations. Can do anything. Can stop suffering. Has wisdom. Has power. Has skillful means. Never gets old. No matter what our physical body looks like, you know, when your daddy practices Tara, you always look the same. And the purpose of your life is always the same. So this is why it's the resultant path. Alright, now, by receiving tantric empowerments, we are enabled to view ourselves as already possessing the body, speech, and mind of an enlightened being, and to view our enjoyments, activities, and environment in a similar fashion. So, you cannot practice deity yoga without, you can't see yourself, well, let me see, you can do anything you want to, but it won't work. Without having a proper empowerment from a qualified guru, this won't work. So, you know, we have to have an empowerment, and we have to get ourselves qualified, and then we can see ourselves as a deity. And then, in the times between sessions, like when you do a retreat, there are different kinds of retreats, but when you do a retreat to do a deity practice, like even between times of meditation sessions, say you do two-hour sessions a day or three-hour sessions a day, whatever. In between times, you always see yourself as the deity. So everything you see is a manifestation of the deity. Everything you do is the action of a deity. Everything you say are the words of a deity. So you see, you know, so all of your enjoyments are the enjoyments of a deity. You see everything from the perspective of a Buddha figure or a meditational deity. In this way, the practice of Tantra becomes a rehearsal for enlightenment and brings about its desired transformation much more rapidly. So we are practicing being a Buddha now. So everything we do is now part of the practice of the deity that we're practicing. So you're walking around in between sessions and thoughts come into your mind and you're trying to see yourself, it's not easy, but you're trying to see yourself as Tara and as empty, you know, not I'm Tara, but, you know, merely labeled Tara, and then negative thoughts come in the mind. They come from emptiness, and they disappear in emptiness. You let them go. Nothing sticks to the deity. Nothing sticks to you as Tara, as that Buddha figure. Okay? So, you know, you see yourself as the deity in between times, 24/7. You try to practice, you try to do this practice, and at least during the retreat, you're building up this self-identity. And the stress rehearsal. And in the retreat, you're also, when you're doing mantra, like Om Dadi Jutadi Turi Soha, you imagine that, for example, at your heart is like, usually it's a lotus and a moon disc, and around, or a sun, usually it's just a moon disc, and around the disc are the letters of the mantra, and then there's a seed syllable in the center. And as you say the mantra, you imagine that you're sending out countless beings to universal, you're sending out, I'm sorry, countless beams of light to universal living beings all around you, and they're all being purified of the negative karma, and they're all receiving teachings from a qualified guru, and they develop themselves, renunciation, bodhicitta, and a correct view of emptiness. They practice generation and completion stage Tantra, and they become Buddhas themselves. And you imagine that you have now enlightened universal living beings. which is your goal, which is what we're practicing for. So you imagine that you are doing the actions of a Buddha now. That's really powerful. So that's not how we ordinarily think, but that's how that works. All right, the characteristics of the practice of Tantra is deity yoga. I'm sorry, my glasses, I have prism in my glasses, and I use that as an excuse for my inability to read. Explain essential features of this practice, including in your explanation the meaning of the term deity and sadhana. We're going to zip through this, but anyway, the term deity, meditational deity, or yidam. So everybody, if you get a qualified guru, you go to your guru and the guru knows your mind, right? And you say, who's my yidam? What practice should I be putting my energy into? Because, you know, you could take initiations into many different tantric deities, but there's probably one practice that you need to really focus your energy on. That's your yidam. Y-I-D-A-M. And so your guru will tell you what your yidam is based on your mental predispositions. You know, let's say you're extremely stupid, so your yidam might be Manjushri, the Buddha of wisdom, right? Or you see yourself as a wimp, so your yidam might be Vajrapani. Or you're very lustful or something like that. Or your yidam might be, for example, Vajrayogini or Haruka, which is a Hashyoga Tantra. Or, different yidams, depending on what our major afflictions are. So in deity yoga we practice, we identify ourselves as having the various enlightened abilities of the meditational deity whose practice we have been empowered to perform. Our daily practice of this deity comes into a form of a sadhana. So this is a sadhana. This is a sadhana. They call them methods of accomplishment. They're little guided meditations that include visualizations and mantras where, again, you're practicing seeing yourself as the deity and doing the various actions of the deity. Deity yoga is not the case of seeing yourself as, you know, some sort of, Napoleon. That's kind of a weird example, but anyway, nor is it a matter of pretending to be a meditational deity as a masquerade. Instead, deity yoga is practiced on the basis of our indwelling Buddha nature. Now, how many people are pretty darn sure they have Buddha nature? Raise your left hand. How do you know that? How do you know it?
Our teachers tell us.
But how about if they lied? How about if they lied? Or you did, you know, it's a good question. Our teachers tell us that. So it's like a lot of things in Buddhism. Sometimes, for example, karma. We can't prove karma. Karma makes a lot of sense. What goes around comes around. If you eat poison, you're going to get sick. Blah, blah, blah. But we say everything is karma. Your world is created right this second by bazillions of karmic seeds that are ripening, forcing you to see yourself at Kadampa Center and forcing you to listen to me. That's karma ripening. It's always ripening. Now, can you and say it again? Oh, thank you, Robbie, for your vote of support. Yeah, I'm not saying it's necessarily good karma, but it is karma. But it's hard to prove it. So what we do is we creatively align, right? Until we can prove it. However, there is a practice called Mahamudra, which you can actually learn how to do, where you can begin to experience your essence. This Buddha nature, you can get a taste of it. Not like, and that's just enough in the beginning. Just a taste that you are not that black hole of a, you know, that we often go there, don't we? We put ourselves down. Most of the conversation that goes on in our head is not uplifting. It is always criticizing, judging, and not always, but the majority of people's internal conversation is not positive. And we believe that. We buy into it because Annabelle, my 10-year-old, was telling me, she's saying, I'm a bad person. I mean, my these voices are telling me I'm, I said, Annabelle, that's not who you are. This little 10-year-old believing in her voices. Most of the time she's happy-go-lucky, but she kind of bought in. You know, she doesn't understand that she doesn't have to believe these voices. She does not have to believe them, and we don't either. Okay? So, we have Buddha nature. So here's a question. Robbie, was it George or somebody said that our reality, our ordinary perception of ourself is based on ego's projection, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Now, how true is that? How true is that? Relatively speaking, yes, I'm a man, you're a woman, blah, 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 and whatever. But how true is that? It's not the truth. It's a misperception of reality. Our ordinary perception is the perception of ignorance. Okay? And seeing ourselves as a deity is actually coming from our true nature. If you buy in, if you believe you have Buddha nature, then seeing yourself as a deity is actually more valid than you're seeing yourself as an ordinary, limited, I can't do this, I can't do that, I got all these bad qualities and blah, 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 and believe in that. You know? So visualizing yourself as a deity is in some ways more accurate than seeing yourself as this polluted, limited person, you know, ordinary person. So, something to think about. To avoid the mistake of retaining our ordinary self-identity and merely pretending to be a deity, it's necessary to practice emptiness yoga, through which we dissolve our ordinary sense of self. This enables us to arise with full conviction as a deity whose empowerment we receive. So I talked about that, didn't I? You imagine, if you do a sadhana, the way this goes is you imagine yourself, there's a place in the sadhana where, and I'm not, this is why, anyway, you're not really supposed to teach this stuff, right? So by doing this, I have created a cause in this class for many years, now close to 20, to go to the Vajra Hells, which are the worst of the worst, right? It's not a good thing. But you're really not supposed to talk about this in just generally speaking, Tantra, because it could be misunderstood. But we talk about it because it's in books. Now, the Dalai Lama said, look, it's in books. You might as well try to, you know, clear up misconceptions that people have about it. So, you know, in Infinite Yoga, we imagine that, for example, the world dissolves into light and it dissolves into our body. And then our body dissolves into light. And then it comes to this little orb at the heart. It completely dissolves into light. And everything focuses this orb. And then it gets smaller, smaller, and smaller, and smaller. And then it disappears. And all that appears to the mind is spaciousness. And what the mind is aware of at that moment of seeing empty space is the voidness of inherent existence, emptiness, wisdom. So we have the mind that is, you know, sees empty space and is aware of wisdom, of shunyata, of the emptiness of inherent existence at the same time. And so this is very similar. Those of you who've done the death dissolution meditation where you dissolve and you see the clear light consciousness, the subtlest, most powerful level of consciousness. You imagine that you've cultivated this most powerful level of consciousness. It's called the Dharmakaya. You know, this subtlest level, this truth body of the Buddha. You imagine that You are that. And you develop divine pride in being the truth body of the Buddha. Right? I am the truth body of the Buddha. I'm pure consciousness. Right? I'm this pure Dharmakaya, truth body of the Buddha. And then from that, then through the force of compassion, we cause this compassionate wisdom consciousness then to arise as something called the Sambhogakaya, which we'll talk about in a second. Usually, sometimes it comes in the form of a vajra or different forms, right? But, and you imagine that you're that, this truth body of a Buddha. All of these Buddha figures, Tara, Chinrezi, are like these Sambhogakaya emanations of the Buddha. They're too subtle. We don't see them directly, even though an Arya being would be able to see these deities, Tara, and all these deities around us. But we our mind's too polluted to be able to do that, right? So, but you have to start from emptiness. You have to do this emptiness yoga. Otherwise, Tantra is just putting on a wetsuit on your polluted sense of who you are and your body. And it doesn't lead to anything except sore knees and a lot of wasted time. Sore knees. So it's really important. Again, you can see a lot of things are really important, aren't they? You got to have compassion. You got to have wisdom. You got to do emptiness yoga. You got to have a good guru. You got to live ethically. And there's a lot of vows in Tantra too. So it's not easy. They say, oh, it's the fastest, quickest. Yeah, give me the what was that jet that used to fly from the Concorde? Yeah. Give me the Concorde. I don't want a rowboat. I don't want to swim to London. I want the Concorde. I want to be there in 3 hours. Not 300 lifetimes or 16 countless eons from now, which is what it takes to get enlightened through the Sutra path. We want deity yoga. Right. All right, so the engine master, Naropa, is talking about the importance of the guru. In order to practice deity yoga, absolutely necessary to receive an empowerment. So there's the biggest empowerment, like the Kala Chakra empowerment that goes on for 3 days. That's called a Wong. And there's a Jainong, which is a shorter empowerment. All right, moving right along. Such an empowerment is a shared meditation between the deity, the guru, and our own mind. And we are seen as essentially one. So this is really important. This is probably the most important part of Tantra. And when you think about it, I liken this to Christianity, which I find it helpful. See, the deity could be likened to God, the guru could be Jesus, and our own mind is our own mind. You know, and so in Christianity, you know, a lot of Christians say, well, we can't relate to God, just, you know, this ethereal being. But we can relate to Jesus who walked on this earth and talked and did good things. And so we try to be, you know, be like Jesus. WWJD. What would Jesus do, right? You can see those little bracelets. You want to be like Jesus. So it's very much like that. We try to, in Tantra, we try to see that the deity, let's say, Green Tara and the guru's mind, while we're doing the initiation, we try to see the deity's mind, the guru's mind, and our mind as inseparably one. We're all empty of inherent existence. We don't see ourselves as, I'm this polluted, limited, sentient being, and the guru, well, he's just another guy or girl, whatever. You know, now we see the Buddha, we see the guru as inseparable from the deity, and the deity is having imperfect qualities, and our mind are inseparably one. And that's all the time. From the moment you get the enlightened, the empowerment, and forever and ever, the rest of this life and all your future lives, as much as you can, you try to see that your deity's mind, your guru's mind, and your mind are inseparably one. Okay? Essentially one nature. And then during our daily practice, we enhance our recognition of identity between the deity and our master and mind through guru yoga. So that's part of the practice, okay? Blah, blah, blah. And then achieving enlightenment is said to fulfill the purpose of oneself and the purpose of others. So I'm not going to go into this Dharmakaya, truth body, Rupakaya, which is the form body, and the Sambhogakaya. Okay, so we don't need to go into it, but those are technical terms. But in Hashtaga Tantra, it's really important. Really important, because in Hashtaga Tantra, we imagine, we actually do the death dissolution meditation. You know, imagine where you die, where you have the different visions, you have the vision of the mirage vision, and then there's smoke, and then there's the fireflies in smoke, and then there's the white appearance, the red, and then the black, and then the subtlest level of consciousness, the clear light consciousness arises. And we want to be able to end this life through the practice of Tantra to literally create the subtlest level of consciousness, which subtle is equated to powerful and can understand reality non-conceptually. We want to be able to see and reality non-conceptually. So the Dharmakaya is this truth body, meditating on this non-conceptual view of reality. Okay, and thinking that I am the Dharmakaya now. So that one, in Hashtaga Tantra, you start out with that, so you get rid of all your ordinary sense of self, and then you, from that, you arise as a Sambhogakaya, and then you think that I am, you have, you know, divine pride in yourself as this Sambhogakaya, which is a form that only Aryas can see, very subtle, but it is a form body. It's not just, the Dharmakaya has no form. But now we have form, and then from the Sambhogakaya, boom, we arise as the Nirmanakaya. Okay? The form that all beings can see. So let's just say the Dalai Lama is a Buddha. Well, he's a Nirmanakaya manifestation. We can see him. We can relate to him. We can get teachings from him, Lama Zopa. So that's the form body of a Buddha. And then the Mahayana path to enlightenment is said to be the union of method and wisdom. Explaining how Hashtaga Tantra transcription of this union differs from Sutra. I'm sorry, it should have been description from Sutra. So this is a little hard to explain because I don't really understand it myself. But I think I can say something about it. All right, so in Sutra, what?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, what is...
This Sambhogakaya and Nirmakaya, how is it that these bodies are to fulfill the purpose of others?
Well...
Because they become teachers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we fulfill the purpose of others because we can now teach them how to solve their own problems. All right. I'm gonna read this because it says wisdom refers to the penetrate. All right. Number one in the sutra path, method and compassion. Method refers to compassion, and wisdom refers. Refers to the emptiness. Right. So usually, method and compassion are sequential. We can never combine these two minds in the same moment of mind. Now this gets pretty esoteric, but just bear with me. You can't combine these in the same moment of mind. But in Tantra, it said we can. We can combine method and wisdom in the same moment of mind. The wisdom is the same wisdom in Sutra. It's the wisdom of emptiness. The method is Deity Yoga. Right? The method. What does the Deity really stand for? Compassion. Compassionate action. So here we are, seeing ourselves as a Deity, the manifestation of compassion and wisdom in the same moment of mind. Now, that's about all I can say about it. You know, it's said that only through Deity Yoga are we able to combine method The other method is bliss. That's part of the blissful awareness of emptiness. It's this blissful awareness of emptiness, and then seeing ourselves as the deity, all in the same moment of mind. So the combination of method and wisdom in the same moment of mind is what makes Tantra so fast, so powerful. You know, it allows us to get enlightened in 3 years rather than 16 countless eons. Long time. So, yeah.
Is this body near Manakaya?
Not this body. The body of
Lama Yeshe.
Yeah, Lama Yeshe, Lama Zopa, is the Dalai right. Lama. Those are, if we believe, again, mm-hmm. you know, we ask people to creatively align with a lot of things here, don't we? You know, that there are past and future lifetimes, that karma exists, that we do have Buddha nature, we do have the potential to be happy beyond our wildest imaginations, we just need to work on our minds. We ask people to align creatively with a lot of things. And so this is part of that process, is aligning with our potential to become a Buddha.
Is the difference between Nirmanakaya, you know, the body of, you know, Lama Yeshe or the Dalai Lama, and yeah. this body due to karma?
Yeah, it's due to karma. You see, we have it. To become the Nirmanakaya, you have to have the pure Dharmakaya. It's the evolution. You become this pure, you know, essence, your Buddha nature, but you identify completely with your subtlest level of consciousness, which is totally pure and blissful. And that becomes literally the seed for the Sambhogakaya, which then becomes the seed for the Nirmanakaya. So a Buddha, to be a Buddha, we've got to evolve. We need to go through those steps. And it's sort of like, sometimes it's likened to like the process of dying. Wait a minute, I'm going to go mess this up here. Yeah, anyway, I'm not going to go there. I'm just going to talk about how sometimes like going to sleep is kind of like the Dharmakaya. And then while we're dreaming, you know, our mind's very active. That's a little bit like the Nirmanakaya. And then when we wake, I'm sorry, the Sambhogakaya, our mind's very active in the dream state. And then when we wake up, that's like the Nirmanakaya, the form body. Okay? It's just another way to think about it. All right, so only Tantra, the last statement here is, again, just not telling anybody to believe it, but this is the position of Mahayana Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism, because only Tantra has the means for generating the simultaneous experience of method and wisdom, it is the most powerful path. Indeed, it is the only path for achieving full enlightenment of a Buddha. So that really is all you need to know about Buddhism, about Vajrayana, but I have a few things to add to it. Any questions about what I've said so far? Please don't ask me any questions. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, I'm here. I'm sorry?
An easy one, yeah. I just wanted to ask about just a clarifying question, because Dalai Lama and all the Lamas being Nirmakayas, and you had answered Audrey's question saying that we didn't have the karma, but is it you're born as a Nirmanakaya body, or you can, through this tantric path, that it is possible for you to still arise as a Nirmanakaya?
I'm just trying to clarify. You can manifest as a Nirmanakaya in this lifetime.
Okay.
You know, through purification, you have to purify your mind, you know, the subtlest level of mind. In other words, there are practices where the pure dharmakaya, sambhogakaya, and nirmanakaya. But it's an evolution. But we can manifest as a nirmanakaya. Now, some people say the Buddha, I'm not going to get into it. There's a lot of gossip, a lot of things I could say about it, but I'm not going to right now. All right, so I just want to touch on a couple of quick points here before we do a practice, okay? All right, one more question. Maybe one more after this.
So if you could please, so His Holiness the Dalai Lama, he practices this highest yoga tantra, and all the yogis would, right? I mean, because this is like the highest practice, tantra.
Is that a question?
I'm asking. Does His Holiness, when he goes into that death stage, right, and he practices several times a day or night, he works with the chakras, so he's working with tantra. He's doing tantra. I mean, is he?
I've never seen him, but I've heard him.
So is that tantra?
Yeah, it's tantra.
Oh, that is tantra.
He gets up at 3 a.m. every morning and practices and meditates for until about
hours,
five,
right?
Or six or seven, and he does his tantric.
So that's the death.
He does these sadhanas, these chakra. Methods of accomplishment. He does mantras and
so
stuff.
So that's what yogis do too, right?
Well, what is a yogi? Yogi is just a meditator.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to be. I mean, you could pretend to be a yogi.
Yeah.
But yogi, the word yoga means to yoke your mind to something. That's what yoga means. Of course, there's physical yoga and there's mental yoga. All right. So, I'm just going to touch on... Oh, I know what I wanted to do. I'm going to read something that Tubten Pandey, I'm going to give him full credit for this.
Don't worry, I cannot keep up to 2 o'clock memories, like I'm up from 3 o'clock, I cannot keep maybe in practice.
Well, you could be doing some sort of major, yeah. All right, so this is... I'll jump over here to Pandey's stuff in a second, but we've already talked about tantra is used to evoke the subtlest level of mind that then can be used to meditate with and perceive reality. It's called the mind of spontaneous great bliss, non-conceptual, clear, and peaceful. So that's what we're trying to evoke through all these elaborate visualizations and all the ritual and all this kind of stuff. It's meant to do one thing, to help us evoke the subtlest level of consciousness and then use that mind to purify our mind and to see reality as it is. So it's the quick path. Only reason to practice Tantra is to achieve enlightenment. The correct motive is a special bodhicitta, this impatient bodhicitta that we talked about. Tantra means continuum. The basis... I'm not going to talk about that. Too much time here. We use our imagination, a special method for liberating... And Tantra has all these amazing methods to liberate our imagination. And then we identify with the Buddha now. Again, that's divine pride. It's not the afflicted pride that we're all well familiar with. By viewing ourselves as a Buddha now, we sow very profound seeds in our mind to enable us to achieve that state in the future. People do this all the time. Sometimes you'll see, like, I can remember seeing this high jumper who used to, like, you could see him go, he'd see himself going over the jump. Or you see golfers, you know, they visualize the shot before they hit it, right? Because they're more likely to hit the good shot. And a good architect, he's got to visualize the thing he's going to do before he does it, right? So we do it all the time. Here we're using it to see yourself as an enlightened being. Okay. And then, this is the last didactic piece. Yay! Shut up. But this is the part everybody's interested in anyway. The path of desire. In many discourses, the Buddha identified desire as an origin of all suffering. Okay? The affliction. Right? Afflictive desire. But there are different kinds of desire. There's afflictive desire, and then there's a desire that's not an affliction, which means it doesn't cause suffering. Consequently, it's been viewed by Buddhists as a poison extraordinaire to be avoided at all cost. Anybody ever been to Thailand? Sri Lanka? Burma? You been to Sri Lanka?
Thailand,
yeah. Have you ever seen the monks on begging rounds? What are they looking at? Are they looking around?
No, looking down.
They're looking down because they don't want to. They don't want to see anything that's going to cause attachment to arise, like an attractive figure. It could be even attractive, like a beautiful flower or something. It could be anything. So they look down, and you know this is part because a desire attachment is seen as a bad thing because it leads to all kinds of problems, right? And the individual vehicle practitioner is said to refer, is said to prefer, you know, like Hinayana or Theravada tradition, they prefer an austere lifestyle to avoid these conditions that give rise to desire. In universal vehicle or Mahayana, sutra practitioner is not intimidated by pleasurable conditions because being protected by wisdom, realizing emptiness of everything. So, I'm not so sure about that. But it said that the Mahayana practitioner is not so intimidated by seeing desirable things because they have an understanding of the emptiness of inherent existence. But how many of us do? You know, maybe everybody here does. The universal vehicle tantric practitioner. Now listen to this. This is really good. This is the best part. The universal vehicle tantric practitioner, however, seeks out pleasurable conditions because they form an essential role in tantric methodology. Just as certain poisons may be employed in the production of life-giving medicines. So in Tantra, you know, a practitioner would seek out, you remember we talked about the four levels of Tantra, right? The first level is just gazing on an attractive figure, right? Somebody, whoever, whatever. We're talking about a person here, an attractive person. Then the second level, which I made a mistake last time, that's action. Performance Tantra is actually gazing into the eyes of this attractive person and more desire arising in the mind, right? Right? And then the third level is this yoga tantra, which is like holding hands. So now we're looking into their eyes and holding their hand. Now even more of this desire energy arises. And then the fourth level, the highest yoga tantra, you use the desire of actual sexual intercourse, of actually having sex. And that desire energy is so powerful. And usually we just, you know, we can't use that energy. We can't use the pleasurable, because we freak out. You know, we're so into our experience, we cannot use it to develop wisdom and compassion. But that's what says possible in Tantra is to, so we don't have to limit anything in our lives. You know, we can use our entire life's experience as spiritual practice if we're skillful practitioners. However, don't think that you can play with fire, i.e. high sugar tantra, because most of us, if having ordinary sex was the cause of enlightenment, I'm not speaking for everybody. There ought to be a lot of Buddhas in this room right now, right? But we're not so sure. But I know I'm not. The rest of you could be. I'll give that credit for that. All right, this can be understood as we look at our own experience. When we experience pleasure, we tend to feel content, satisfied, and exhilarated. While experiencing pleasure, we're not looking at the object of our experience as insufficient for our needs. We're not looking around for something else, nor are we depressed with low energy. This, of course, is one short step away from clinging desire. So he's saying when we experience pleasure, You know, it's not identical to clinging desire, but we're one step, we're very close, we're one step away from clinging desire that cannot bear to be separated from the pleasurable object. However, it is this blissful experience that we can cultivate in Tantra is conducive to developing single-pointed concentration that is free of the obstacles of scanning and laxity. In other words, when your mind is joyful and blissful and happy, you don't want to go anywhere, do you? You just want to be, you can put that mind, you can focus that mind on reality, you can focus it on compassion, you can focus it on wisdom, you can focus it on bodhicitta, you can make amazing progress very quickly. So concentration is the essential tool for the cultivation of wisdom. You know, Tantra has special techniques to develop concentration more quickly. Not only will the experience of concentration and the pleasure induced by Tantra eclipse ordinary pleasures, thus freeing us from the most common forms of clinging desire, when that concentration is focused on emptiness of inherent existence, giving rise to the wisdom that directly experiences reality, clinging desire will totally be uprooted. So, when we can use the wisdom developed in Tantra, that it's focused, it totally destroys clinging. Totally destroys it. So last paragraph. This is exemplified by the fire that depends on wood to burn. And in the process of its existence consumes the fuel that it depends upon. Likewise, our attention is naturally attracted to pleasurable objects and remains with those objects for as long as pleasure is experienced. When attention is conjoined with penetrating wisdom, the ordinary aspect of the object disappears. So now think about what I'm saying. When that attention, that pleasurable consciousness, is conjoined with wisdom, the ordinary aspect of the object disappears where our mind merges with reality. So, you know, when you see, like if you're looking at this desirable person you have in this experience, they disappear in emptiness. And what you're left with is this blissful awareness of reality. So it's very cool. Pleasure is not interrupted when the ordinary aspect of the object vanishes. Rather, it assumes new proportions as the mind that experiences reality is relieved of all the encumbrances of ignorance and enjoys the natural state of a liberated mind. So, you know, Tantra is kind of cool because it really doesn't exclude any of our experiences and it encourages us to enjoy ourselves. I mean, she says, the West, he says, where you people live is perfect for Tantra. You know, because y'all are, you know, there's so many opportunities, you know, to have blissful experiences and to have pleasure and fun where, you know, in Asia, you know, a lot of people just live in hand to mouth. All right, so now we're going to do Vajrasattva. But get up and stretch your legs for a few minutes, and then we'll do that practice together. Might end up going over a few minutes, but it's okay. Wow.
You want me to get more of these little
books? Yeah. Actually, you know what? The people who don't have it. Yeah.
If they don't have it memorized, these words.
What now?
If they don't have the mantra
memorized. Yeah, I'm going to read it. So okay. If they don't have one.
Well, then they might not need it. Then. I'll put it in the mantra.
Yeah, okay. If they want to get it, they can get it. Okay. So now we're going to purify eons of negative karma in the next 20 minutes. Okay, because the reason we're not forced, the reason at this moment we're not having the karma is not ripening for us to see ourselves as a deity and blissfully aware and, you know, whatever. The reason we don't have that karma ripening is because we haven't created the karma for that. It's so polluted. So we've got a garden and there's some beautiful plants in there, but they're being choked by the weeds. So we got to weed the garden by doing this Vajrasattva meditation. So this is this little booklet. And, so I don't know if I even talked about this in the Vajrasattva retreat, Aaron, but I'm going to say it tonight anyway. There's a reason, there's several images of Vajrasattva. I don't see the one.
I don't think there's one.
Well, there's a Vajrasattva, just one figure, like a solo image of a white Buddha figure, Vajrasattva. And it's usually a male, and Vajrasattva has the bell in one hand and the Vajra in the other, crossed at the heart, right? A union of method and wisdom. The bell symbolizes female energy or wisdom, and the Vajra symbolizes method or compassion. So the union of method and wisdom, right? And that's how you see Vajrasattva. Here, if you look at the front of this image, you have Lama Zopa actually wanted people to use this image. Well, this is Hashyogatantra image of Vajrasattva. This is a male and female deity, but it's called Vajrasattva, inseparably one, but they're in sexual union. So right away, all of a sudden we've gone from one guy to a male and female deity in sexual union. So you can imagine, if you visualize that above your head, it's a little different experience, isn't it? A lot more stuff's going to come up, so to speak, when you see this image, if you think it's ordinary. But it's not. It's just we're using our imagination to create an image, to visualize an image of a Buddha above our head, who's going to help us purify our body, speech, and mind. Okay? Now, there are three visualizations that when we're going to read through this. And this is based on the four opponent powers. Do you want to come up closer? You've been sitting in the back. You okay? Okay. So, the four opponent powers, you know, everybody should know the four opponent powers who's been through discovering Buddhism. But if you don't, you should know these. The first one is the power of reliance. So we rely on the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and bodhicitta, and compassion. You know, as a Buddhist, we rely, just like when you fall down, you rely on the ground to help get up. Well, we rely on the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to help us get up, to help our purify our minds. Okay? So that's the power of reliance. Then the second one is the power of regret. We have to bring to mind the stuff that we've done wrong, that has harmed ourselves and others. We have to be honest with ourselves. Okay? And we have to have, what's the Catholic word? Contrition. We have to regret that we've done these things. So we go through the three of body. And like I said, we've done them all, and we've done them countless times in former lifetimes. So don't think we're so pure. We're not. We got a lot of negative karma to purify. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, or the three of body. And the visualization that we'll do as we do the Vajrasattva mantra, Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manopalaya, when we do that 100-syllable mantra together, and if you don't know the mantra, you just listen and do the visualization. But what you'll do is you'll visualize light and nectar coming from the heart of Vajrasattva, father and mother, you know, these deities in union, and that nectar will come down through the lower part of their body into the crown of your head. And as you purify the negative karma of killing and stealing and adultery, you imagine that nectar completely washes away all of your physical negative karma right out through a hole in the ground. It disappears forever. Okay? So that, so you've got a lot to keep in mind. You know, this deity is inseparable from the Buddha, right? And your mind. And you're creating this visualization to purify your mind. Okay? And so, as you say that, this to purify your negative karma of body, you do this visualization. Then as you continue it, the next visualization, and we'll talk, I'll say, okay, now we're going to switch. The next one's to purify your speech. And you imagine, like if you had this cup had a couple of holes that stood for your ears and some nostrils and a mouth, right? But it was a lot of dirt at the bottom. If you poured this water into the cup, eventually what would come out of the holes? Dirt would float up to the top and come out of the holes, right? Similarly, we imagine that the negative karma of speech, similarly, as we say it, it comes up from below and it comes out through the, we feel that this filthy negative karma comes out of our, you know, nose and our eye sockets and our ears and our mouth, and we're pure, our speech is purified. So lying, slander, harsh and frivolous speech, okay? And then the last visualization is we imagine that the nectar, again, coming from Vajrasattva's holy, you know, this visualization that we have in front of us, completely made of light, like hologram, and it's not hologram. You imagine that there's a living presence. It's a living presence of an enlightened being, male and female, in union, the nectar is coming from the heart, coming down through their body, through the crown of our head, and this time is purifying our mind. It's like turning on a light. It's like our mind is, it's like our body is completely darkened, and it's like, boom, we turn on the light, and we're completely lit up. And we imagine, as we say the mantra, that our mind is completely purified of all the, you know, greed and hatred, and ignorance, and the 84,000 delusions, pride, jealousy, all the negative mind states, all the stories and crap that we made up ourselves, completely purified. Okay? Now, as we do these, one of the features of Vajrasattva's mantra, 100-syllable mantra, is if you do a retreat with this, guess what happens? Here's what you're doing. You're imagining, you try to sit perfectly still, and you're doing the mantra, right? You got your little mala here, if you got a mala. You're doing your mantra, and you're doing this mantra, and you're trying to do this visualization of Vajrasattva above the crown of your head, and purifying your body, and nectar's getting in the crown of your head, and you're being purified, and you go, you kind of freak out. All of a sudden, stuff cuts coming up, like you cannot believe. You dredge up stuff, you purify negative karma of body, all of a sudden, every time, any one of these three things you've done, if you've ever done them in this life, you'll see it. It'll be right there in front of you. Plus, countless other, even pain in the body, you'll have, you know, your body might get, all kinds of stuff will come on you, but your back might ache, your shoulders might ache, you might get a headache, all kinds of stuff comes up. When we do Vajrasattva's mantra, and you get to see it, it comes from the space of emptiness, you experience it, it just is what it is, and then it's impermanent and it disappears. You just stay with the mantra. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya. You do it, we'll do it seven times. We'll do that one seven times to purify the body. And then when you do it seven more times, again, all this negative stuff comes up. Vajrasattva is like a roto-rooter for negativity. I promise you. You will get to, you know, one of my friends, you know, when many years ago, I did this retreat. He told me, he said, you're not supposed to tell people you're going to do the retreat. This was before I did it. So don't tell anybody you can do the retreat because it creates obstacles. Don't tell anybody. If anybody asks you what you're going to do, just tell them you're going to investigate the nature of your mind. I tell you, that's what this retreat is about. You get to see your mind and what a mess it is. At least I did. And John Lendell said the same thing. He said he really developed profound sense of renunciation that he really wanted to be free from suffering because after having done this retreat. So you do this practice and you really get to see how your mind works and how all of this stuff that's been made up is just that. It's just been made up and it disappears. It's just like clouds passing by. It's just the truth for an ignorant consciousness. All that stuff that comes up, even the feelings, anything physical, any experience, mental, physical, that comes up, it's all impermanent and it disappears. You know, it comes from the space of emptiness and it disappears back into emptiness. It doesn't last. Okay? So Bodhisattva is so good for that. Such a great practice. So we've got, alright, power of reliance, the power of regret, then the power of the remedy. This is the remedy, is doing the mantra. And then the last thing is the power of the, this is an R, but I usually say promise. What's the way? What is it?
Resolve,
yeah, same thing. And some people say it's the most important part of it. You have to promise not to do it again for a minute, an hour, a day. I know in AA, I think they say one day at a time. You know, just do it one day at a time. But you need to make a promise. It's so important that you make a promise to do, maybe it's a promise, I promise to never do that again. To the best of my ability in this lifetime, I'm never going to do those things again that I did that harmed me and others. Or if you have something that you, like getting angry, something that you do a lot, and you know that you can't promise to never get angry again, you promise you're not going to get angry until you get on the highway driving home. That's an easy place to get angry, isn't it? There's a lot of road rage out there. So you promise for a, don't tell another lie and create more negative karma, right? So you want to be straight about it. Okay? So, we're ready to go. Alright, so sit up straight. If you got this little booklet, there'll be some parts in here that we can read together. And then there'll be part of it that I'll read to you. Let's just start out by doing... by the way, how many people have memorized a 100-syllable mantra? Okay. If you haven't, you can read it. Although I really... The power of this practice really has to do with doing the visualization. So if you cannot do the mantra, listen to the words of the mantra and do the visualizations that I've just described to you. All right, so thank you, Lama Zopa, for giving us this practice. All right? So take a couple of deep cleansing breaths and let go of all the Mickey Mouse talk. That I've a lot of stuff, a lot of things to think about. A lot of seeds planted. All right, on page 9 in the booklet, we'll read this power of dependence or reliance, taking refuge. Now, if you're not a Buddhist, again, you can just say it along or you can just look along. But we'll do this 3 times. I forever take refuge in, now let's do this together. I forever take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge in all the 3 vehicles, in the dakas and dakinis of secret mantra yoga, in the heroes and heroines, the gods and goddesses, and in the bodhisattvas of the 10 bhumis. But most of all, I take refuge in my holy guru forever. I forever take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge in all the 3 vehicles, in the dakas and dakinis of secret mantra yoga, in the heroes and heroines, the gods and goddesses, and the bodhisattvas of the 10 bhumis. But most of all, I take refuge in my holy guru forever. I forever take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. I take refuge in all the 3 vehicles, in the dakas and dakinis of secret mantra yoga, in the heroes and heroines, the gods and goddesses, and the bodhisattvas of the 10 bhumis. But most of all, I take refuge in my holy guru forever. Now the power of regret. First, recall the definition of negative karma, any action that results in suffering. usually an action motivated by ignorance, attachment, or aversion. So any action that results in suffering, you know, the long-term result is suffering. Because short-term happiness, pleasure, is not the same thing as long-term suffering. So the long-term result of an action, is suffering. It's usually motivated by greed, hatred, and ignorance, and it will always cause suffering. All right. Almost every action I do, 24 hours a day, is motivated by worldly concern, attachment to the comfort of this life. It's like this from birth to death in this life, and has been like that from beginningless rebirths. Nearly every action I've ever created has been non-virtuous, the cause of suffering. Not only that, but continuously, I have also been breaking my pratimoksha, bodhisattva, and tantric vows. So these are different levels of vows that you would have taken if you were practicing a Buddhist or tantric practitioner. Worst of all, I've created the heaviest of negative karmas in relation to my virtuous friends, that's our gurus. Getting angry at them, generating wrong views, having non-devotional thoughts toward them, harming their holy body, and disobeying their advice. Having these negative imprints on my mental continuum is unbearable. It's as if I'd swallowed a lethal poison. I must practice the antidote right away and purify all negative karma immediately without a second's delay. In this way, generate strong feelings of urgency and regret. It said that the only actions that lead to happiness are actions motivated. And see, this is it. We can only know our own motivation, right? Only actions motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance. They always lead to happiness. And actions motivated by hatred, attachment, and ignorance always lead to suffering. And Lama Zopa is saying, mostly, we've just created the causes for future suffering. And we must purify our mind ASAP. You know, before we die, which could happen in any moment. So that's the next part, remembering impermanence and death. Many people my age or younger have died. It's a miracle that I'm still alive and have this incredible opportunity to purify my negative karma. Death is certain, but its time is uncertain. If I were to die right now, I would definitely be born in the lower realms, the joyless realms. Because I could not practice Dharma there, I would remain in these lower realms. And there's the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the hell realms in Buddhist cosmology. You can't practice the Dharma there for countless... Because I could not practice Dharma there, I would remain in the lower realms for countless eons. Therefore, how unbelievably fortunate I am to be able to purify my negative karma right now without even a second's delay by practicing the Vajrasattva meditation recitation. But I'm not practicing this Vajrasattva purification. Now, this is bodhicitta, generating bodhicitta. I'm not practicing this Vajrasattva purification for myself alone. The purpose of my life is to release all hell, all the beings of all the realms. The hell beings, the pretas, the animals, the humans, the asuras, the jealous gods, and the gods. All of these beings in the six realms of samsara and the intermediate state beings from all their suffering and its causes and lead them to unsurpassed enlightenment. In order to do this, I must first reach enlightenment myself. Therefore, I must purify all my negative karma immediately by practicing the Vajrasattva meditation recitation. Above the crown of my... Now, here's the visualization. So just... Listen, and I'm going to read this, and you'll, to the best of your ability, try to generate this visualization. It's on the front of the book, but you're going to see it completely made of light. Above the crown of my head, seated upon a lotus, okay, so you see the lotus, then on top of that is like a moon cushion, or Vajrasattva, father and mother. Their bodies are white, Each has one face and two arms. He holds a dorje, really, which symbolizes, which is that little thing like that. It symbolizes male energy or method. She and holds a bell, and she holds a curved knife and a skull cup. So they have certain symbolic meanings too. All made of light. They're embracing each other. The father is adorned with six mudras, which has to do with symbolic meaning. We don't need to go into that. And the mother with five. He sits in the Vajra posture, and she sits in the lotus posture. Okay? And so you imagine that this living presence, it's not some static image. It's not like a statue above your head. It's not a hologram above your head. It's a living presence of Vajrasattva, father and mother, and who's, we've created this with our mind, but we want to believe that this being, Vajrasattva, is truly above the crown of our head and can help us purify our body, speech, and mind. Alright? Vajrasattva is my root guru, the holy mind of all the Buddhas, the Dharmakaya, who out of his unbearable compassion, which embraces me and all other sentient beings, appearing in this form to purify me and all others. In this way, your mind is transformed into guru devotion, the root of all blessings and realizations of the path to enlightenment. On the moon disk, now here we go, this visualization gets a little elaborate, but for most of us, just having a sense of Vajrasattva above the crown of your head is enough. Maybe you can see a light, but if you can see in great detail, and with practice you can, your visualization can be honed to have incredible detail. Okay? On the moon disk, Vajrasattva's heart stands a seat in the middle of that moon disk, and his heart is the seed syllable hum, H-U-M, okay? And then circling around that disk are the syllables of the 100-syllable mantra that we're going to recite. A powerful stream of white nectar flows from the hum and the mantra garland, all the syllables of the mantra. And I'm cleansed of all sicknesses, spirit harm, negative karma, and obscurations of body, speech, and mind. Okay? So here we have it. We've got above the crown of our head is a lotus, a moon disk, and Vajrasattva. And Vajrasattva is like a hologram. Every atom of Vajrasattva, and it's the living presence of Vajrasattva, male and female, and sexual union. At their heart is the mundus with the hum in the center, and all the syllables of the mantra. And as we say the mantra, nectar and light flows down for that mantra through the lower part of their body to the crown of our head. And the first seven times we do it together, it comes all the way through the body, and we're going to purify all the negative karma of this life and all of our previous lifetimes of body. Okay? And that black, imagine just filth and goop just all disappearing below us into a hole and disappears in the space beneath us. Okay? So we're going to, and if you can't remember the mantra, who knows the tune to the mantra? Need a little help here? All right, Linda? Because I'll mess it up. Okay, go ahead. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Dino Patita Dino Me Bawa Sudokayo Me Bawa Supo Siddhi Me Payacha Sawa Kama Sucha Me Sridham Sridham Om Vajrasattva Samaya. Om Vajrasattva Samaya.
Supakaya mebava, sutukaya mebava, anurakta mebava, sarva siddhi meprayacha, sarva karma suchami, chitam shriyam kuruhum, ha 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 ha, bhagavan, sarva tatagata, vajramami muncha, vajrabhava mahasamaya, sattva ahum pe. Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopatishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakto Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tanopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakto Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Maha Samaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tanopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakto Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Maha Samaya Sattva Ahum Te Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tanopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakto Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Maha Samaya Sattva Ahum Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chiram Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Te Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tanopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 Ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supakaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tathagata Vajramami Muncha Vajrabhava Maha Samaya Sattva Ahum Pe
Alright, now imagine completely purified all the negative karma in this life and all of our past lifetimes. And again, we're using our imagination, but you want to feel like you've been purified, that something's actually shifted. And you have purified negative karma of speech. Now we're going to do the visualization of like the light going on. As soon as the light nectar from Vajrasattva enters the crown of our head, the darkness of ignorance is dispelled, like turning on a light in a dark room, instantly dispelled. We focus on that light, the darkness being dispelled by this light and nectar as we do it. And this purifies all the negative karmas of the mind. Om Bhadrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopati Shodito Merbhava Sutokaya Merbhava Supokaya Merbhava Anurakta Merbhava Sarva Siddhi Merprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Sriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Maha Samaya Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supokaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chiram Sriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supokaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chiram Sriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supokaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Shriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supokaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Karma Suchami Chitam Sriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supokaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chiram Sriyam Yam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe Om Vajrasattva Samaya Manupalaya Vajrasattva Tenopa Tishto Dido Mebhava Sutokaya Mebhava Supokaya Mebhava Anurakta Mebhava Sarva Siddhi Meprayacha Sarva Karma Suchami Chitam Sriyam Kuruhum Ha 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 ho Bhagavan Sarva Tata Gata Vajramami Mucha Vajrabhava Mahasamaya Sattva Ahum Pe And now feel that your body, your mind has completely been purified of all delusions, greed, hatred, and ignorance. Now, we're going to read, if you can turn to page 16, we'll read this together. As you have it, you can, well, anyway, yeah, it's fine. If you don't have a little booklet, you can just read along or listen. From the crown of my head, Guru Vajrasattva says, Son of the race, your negativities, obscurations, broken and damaged pledges have been completely purified. Generate strong faith that they have been completely purified, just as Guru Vajrasattva has said. Then the power of refraining. This is the power of the promise or the... Aaron, what'd you say?
Resolve.
Resolve. Yeah. Alright, so this is the fourth of the four planet powers. Before Guru Vajrasattva, I vow never again to commit those negative actions from which I can easily abstain, and not to commit for a day, an hour, or at least a few seconds those negative actions from which I find it difficult to abstain. Then, now imagine Guru Vajrasattva is extremely pleased with your pledge. Vajrasattva, father and mother, melt into light and dissolve into the crown of your head, into your body. And your body, speech, and mind become inseparably one with Guru Vajrasattva's holy body, speech, and mind. So you're seeing your body is complete, your body, speech, and mind is completely purified, but you're not seeing yourself, you're not, you know, visualizing yourself as Vajrasattva, but your body, speech, and mind are inseparably one from the pure body, speech, and mind of Vajrasattva. And generate, you know, as much as possible some faith that this really has happened to you. That you really have purified your mind, and now your body, speech, and mind is inseparably one from Vajrasattva's pure body, speech, and mind. And feel that, and feel it as much as you can. Try to feel that this is true. Now the dedication verses. And this is the dedication, since we're running over, this is the dedication for our class too. And I just want to say thank you, those of you who persevered to be here, because we planted like lots and lots of seeds. Maybe confusion, hopefully some something good, planting good seeds that will ripen definitely in future happiness. So we want to dedicate all this merit. So in emptiness, there is no I, creative negative karma. There's no action of negative karma. I'm sorry, no action in negative karma. There's no negative karma created. Place your mind in that emptiness for a little while. In this way, look at all phenomena as empty. They do not exist from their own side. With this awareness of emptiness, dedicate the merits. Due to all the merits of the three times, this past, present, and future, collected by me, Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and all the other sentient beings, which appear to be real from there, but which are empty, may I, which appears to be real, but is empty, achieve Guru Vajrasattva's enlightenment, which appears to be real, but is empty, and lead all sentient beings who appear to be real, but are totally empty, to that enlightenment, which appears to be real, but is empty, by myself alone, which appears to be real, but is also totally empty, non-existent from there. May the precious bodhicitta, the source of all happiness and success from myself and all other sentient beings, be generated within my own mind and in the minds of all sentient beings without even a second's delay. And may that which has been generated be increased. May I and all other sentient beings have Lama Tsongkhapa as our direct guru in all our lifetimes, never be separated from even a second from the pure path that is greatly praised by the conqueror Buddhas, and actualize the complete path, the three principles of the path, the two stages of highest yoga tantra, and the root of which is guru devotion, within our minds as quickly as possible. Just as the brave Manjushri and Samantrabhadra realize things as they are, I dedicate all these virtues in the best way that I may follow after them. Whatever dedication the three times victorious ones gone to bliss have as admired as best, in the same way, also perfectly dedicate all these roots of virtue so that I may perform good works. Amen. Hallelujah. So, you know, thanks again, everybody, for you coming and hanging in there tonight. I went over, but I, you know, I had some things I wanted to say, and I got them said, and we got to do Vajrasattva. By the way, Venerable Robina says that if we don't purify our negative karma using this practice at night, every night, Bobby, what does Robina say? She says it's a terrible waste. It's like we'd be crazy not to do it. Understanding that karma, negative karma, is going to ripen in suffering, and we have a chance to purify it, to weed our garden. We have a chance to weed the garden before those weeds take off. You know, they grow exponentially. So we can, again, this is an awesome practice to do at night before you go to bed. If you now that you've had a little experience of it, very good practice to do. And I know, you know, a lot of people here, some people here have been doing this practice for years. And it's a really cool practice. So thank you. And so anything Aaron Wilson needed to say?
If anybody wants to sign the card for Don and they didn't get a chance, it's on the back table. I forgot to mention that we have these completion cards. So some of you have been keeping track of what you do in each module, and you can fill that out up at the top, and then our teachers will sign for us. There's a section that's doing the Kadampa Center work. There's a little bit more work for the FDMT level, and I'd be happy to talk to anybody about that who's working on it. But Steve always tells us, because she actually did the Discovering Buddhism module as a student after we started at Kadampa Center, that keep track. You never know. You could be one of the people that actually completes all the work.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think... next week we're having a celebration.
Yeah, everybody please come. The first part of it will be structured, so if you're not, like, into socializing or something like that, you can just come for the beginning part, and Geshe Law is invited, and it sounds like he's going to come, so it's always really inspiring to hear from him, and our teachers all invited, and everybody who emails RSVP'd and say, Robbie, please come too. He's coming.
I'm out of town.
Oh, you're out of town. Okay.
Well, we're going to Skype Robbie in from South France.
Oh, really? Way out of town.
He's going to the Holy Land.
Okay.
His annual pilgrimage to Paris.
I'm sure.
Robbie gets an opportunity to transform.
Robbie is typically the one who teaches the first module in the first cycle, which will be beginning in January. So hopefully we'll be fortunate enough to have him lead that course again, the Mind and Its Potential, in January. So we'll make that aspiration.
Yes, thank you.
I got the question, can you bring anything?
Yeah,
like a snack or something? I think that's an excellent idea.